we look at how human beings function, right, in their lives, human beings have functioned in life for many, many, many thousands of years, what we're looking at is essentially an understanding that there's an individual, right? And of course, when we take the spiritual dimensions, then they go, we're all one and blah, blah, blah. But that's a different thing. We're talking about how human beings navigate life, normal, mundane life, right? Even precognitive, right? So there's the organism, and then that organism is part of a bigger organism, which is the tribe, the family, the tribe, and then, of course, the earth, and then the universe, so to speak, right? And so we have in the body an innate understanding that we are one organism making up a much bigger organism. Now, unfortunately, of course, a lot of that has gone by the wayside nowadays, and we're no longer, you know, connected to that innate knowledge, but it's there. It's not lost at all. It's just that we don't tap into or utilize that part of our being as fluidly and easily as we used to. But our instincts, our knowledge, our intuition, our ability to survive via the nervous system and all of that is intact. Right? It's just dormant or unattended to. So with that said, for you to function as an organism, you have to understand that the organism always wants to sustain itself, right? Mm-hmm. Every organism wants to. Even an ant, if you try to squish it, right, will run. And the ant isn't going, oh, there's a human, there's a hand coming. That human does not mean well. Or does that human mean well? Right? There's none of that. It's like, oh, shit, danger. Like, let's run as fast as you can, right? Because the organism wants to survive. And the human organism is built for survival. Fight or flight, freeze, you know, rest and digest, all the other, you know, autonomic responses in the system, and so on, are there so you can survive and you can thrive. And so in the context of that, there is something that is described as individuation. You know that, right? I'm making this super simple for the therapists in the room, I'm sorry. So in the context of individuation, what we can say is that you realize at some point that you are an individual, that you're an separate organism, separate from your mother, separate from God, the universe, however you want to say that. And that individuation then allows you to form an identity with which you can navigate life and your relationship and your job and everything. In the process of individuation, what often happens is that we form a self-belief that isn't necessarily true, right, or right, but it's what we think we are. And then based on that self-belief, we build all kinds of behaviors to make up for perceived shortcomings or to get the love we want from our families or to succeed in a hostile environment or to thrive in a pleasant environment, right? So depending on what happens and how you're growing up, you'll have coping skills that allow you to function optimally under the circumstances, even under duress, even with abuse, even with whatever. You develop some way of being that allows you to function. So people who have had transgression or abuse or neglect in their upbringing are often incredibly effective and able to control their environment because that is how they derive the sense of safety. That same control of the environment can be very positive, as in super organized, super reliable, shows up when they say they do. They're conscientious, you can trust them, but then of course the flip side can be eating disorders, exercise disorders, OCD behavior, whatever, right? So these are the coping things I'm talking about. People who had a very loving upbringing, let's say, also have coping skills. And the coping skills might be the chasm between how it is at home and how it is in school, right? Because just because your parents love you does not mean that you don't get bullied in school or, you know, shit like that. So everybody has their stuff. And so that stuff then becomes who you become, including the way you dress and look and want to look and all of that. And that then shapes your vision of things and shapes your belief about things. So the stories we tell, you know, I'm making here quotation marks, the stories we tell are our lens based on how we are shaped. So I gave her that beautiful Viking warrior card, right? And she had a total meltdown about it. Because to you, you look at that and you go, fuck, I'm done fighting so hard. I'm done defending. I'm done having to be hardened and in battle and stuff like that, right? So your view makes that, and that's, by the way, been really interesting with these cards, how people interpret them. I'm like, what? You know? And but that's the beauty of the cards. That's why I made them, right? So you go, well, fuck that. I don't want that. Somebody else goes, yeah, yeah. You know, that's exactly what I want, right? So there is the story that you tell yourself. So your story is something like, you're tired of fighting. And then I said to her, well, you could look at her and you could see that she's just a warrior of love, right? She's so loving. Her heart is so big that it's the sword and the shield of boundary, right? It's like, don't come any closer. And if you do, I will cut you, poke you, stick you with a sword, whatever, right? But it's from a place of deep love and also from a place of experience. So you can look at that card as the result of you having battled a lot and now having come to the end of that road, and you're properly boundaried and you're properly defended and your heart can be wide open behind that shield and the sword. Or you can go, oh God, you know, toil, more hardship, more whatever. And that's your lens. So that's your story determines your viewpoint on things. That's true for everything we do. We can only perceive things based on the way we are bent, so to speak, how we are configured. And so a big part of growing up, and we always have to grow up a little bit more, is to not take that too seriously. Right, and get enough distance from this stuff. This is when they talk about being triggered, right? When you're triggered, you don't have distance. There's no beat between what you see and what slams into it. With a little bit of insight, and insight then would be removing yourself enough, right? Where you, in an organized way, step back and you go, why am I reacting like this? So you don't go, fuck no, right? You go, and you pull enough back and you go, what's that about, right? And you inquire. And then in the inquiry, you try on a different perspective. So when you say, when is it important to believe the stories or be with the stories, and when is it important to step back? It's both. The story is a valuable way of living in the world that has served you well, but every story has to constantly grow and develop, and the way you do that is by adding more story to the story, right? You let the story continue to grow. You let the story continue to shape itself in different ways. The story doesn't end. The story continuously evolves, and how you do that is by stepping back. And sometimes somebody else can say to you, step back. Or sometimes you can do it yourself. Sometimes you can't do it. And, you know, a therapist or a friend or whatever has to say, okay, this is your story, you know. But there's you don't do this, but there is people, we want to say that, they're so in love with their story, right? All you ever hear is the story, and they know it's a story, but they're so identified with the story as their identity that there's like no way out of it. It's all about, well, yeah, that is because X.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It feels like a prison.
It is a prison, yeah. Yes. And it's a prison for them too, but they can't get out for whatever reason. And the story becomes the identity, and not the identity shapes the story. So that's the way to look at that. We can see in an archetype, for instance, or in a flavor, or in a folkloric tale, that what we are working with is just the human condition. And just now, right, when we had this conversation about breasts and breast implants or not or whatever, immediately other people have that experience, and that Annette's story is essentially like the folkloric tale or the archetypal tale of that struggle, but it's not hers, so she can pull out enough to see it from outside in. She can identify, but it's not her. And that is what myth is good, and that is what story is good, and that's what Bhuvaneshwari or Chamunda are good for. There are representations of pieces of us, and of course in deities it's exalted pieces of us, meaning the best possible unpacking of what is possible as a human. That's what deities are, right? They're exalted examples of who we are. And when I'm saying exalted, I mean it's what's possible when we actually are true to ourselves, right? Because we are that. We are all of that. We are that divinity, that devotion, that fierceness, that destruction, that rebuilding, that death, that life. All of that's the human experience encapsulated in the organism that is, you know, waddling down the beach, you know. So, you know, and so that's why deity yoga is a very important, important to me, I should say, right? It's important to me as a means of a teaching that's not preachy and that's not cultish and that doesn't require you to conform to my norms of existence. And so that's why when Sarah was saying, oh, I can read what Chamunda is about, I said no, because it's actually much more important that you find the qualities you need. There's a bit of a story, right? Who she is, where she's coming from. You know, there's a little bit of folklore. But we're not going into the details because it's your exalted qualities that she mirrors to you. It's the vortex of your belly in her belly, you know, and different people do see different things. And this is also true for Bhuvaneshwari, who will go in tomorrow. And some of these deities are very healing, right? Because they essentially pop you out of previous injury, let's say, right? They pop you out of violation or out of, being too big. Well, lots of people were saying, I'm considered too loud, too big, my eyes, you know, like you can use the representation of the deity to reconcile who you are and make sense of who you are and add to who you are and become the person that goes beyond just satisfying your base needs of, you know, am I loved? Am I sexy? Do I look good? Have I eaten enough? Do I have the nice enough car, house, clothing, whatever? And you can go, this is my exalted offering to the world. And that's devotion, right? Is to actually say, I'm going to try and give the best of me as a service to whomever, you know, your children, your husband, your community, your clients or whatever. And so that's what myth and story and folklore and archetypes and deities do. They offer a, you know, in Jungian terms, it's the collective unconscious, like it's the collective unconscious wealth is offered through these depictions so we can be part of that wealth. And so we can develop the pieces of that wealth that are true for us.